Philip Mantle, the former director of investigations for the British UFO Research Association, is the Mutual UFO Network's representative for England and is an honorary member of the Research Institute on Anomalous Phenomena in the Ukraine. Philip Mantle has published one book entitled Without Consent, A Study of UFO Abductions in the UK, which he co-authored with Carl Nagaitis. He is an international lecturer on the subject of UFOs and has also worked for a variety of television and radio companies around the world. My pleasure to introduce tonight Philip Mantle to Coast to Coast. Hi, Philip. How are you?
Good evening. I'm fine. Thank you.
God, it's so good to talk with you, Philip. We've heard so much about you over the years and your investigation. How did Philip Mantle get involved in this?
Well, I've always been interested. I mean, I think back as far as I can as a young boy, I was always interested in certainly the space race at the time, but also the paranormal. And they tended to sort of run on parallel lines. You know, I was the young boy when we could stand up in class, talk about our pet subject. It wasn't my rabbit or, you know, soccer. Mine was ghosts and poltergeists and flying saucers. And then in the late 1970s, I was also an amateur astronomer, and I was with a friend in the west of England using an observatory. And we read a little book, and it mentioned UFOs, which we didn't know a lot about, but there was a place nearby called Warminster in Wiltshire, where apparently there was a lot of sightings. So, hey, presto, we took a trip, stood on the hillside, and we saw these strange lights one evening. And that sparked the interest even more intensely. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Well, I got to tell you, your work with this book, Mysterious Sky, Soviet UFO Phenomena, is fascinating, primarily because to me, Philip, not a lot of information came out of the Soviet Union, of course, during the Cold War, and you were able to extract this. Now, how did you go about with your research?
Well, again, it came about quite by chance. In the 1980s, there was a very big sighting at a place called Voronezh, late 1980s, in the former Soviet Union. But just purely by coincidence, I was interviewed by a number of Russian newspapers. And they just said my name and where I lived. And then the letters from Russia started dropping through my letterbox, most of them in Russian. And it was not just from researchers, it was from, you know, members of the public recounting their own experiences, their own sightings. I knew my colleague, Paul Stonehill. Paul is originally from the Ukraine, but now lives in California. Worked together with Paul translating some of this material. And Paul and I, at that point, were commissioned to write a small book called the Soviet UFO Files, which we did. But the material still kept coming through our letterbox, and we got to know most of the Russian UFO researchers. And we decided that you know, the time was right to put this information into the public domain, simply because we hear very little, even today, from the former Soviet Union. Not so much now because of the restrictions. A lot of those have been relaxed. But, of course, the language barrier. It's very difficult to translate the information. And we were ideally placed. You know, information came into my office in the UK. It did so to Paul in California. And we're fortunate that Paul, you know, speaks and writes the language. So we thought, well, it would be a great idea to translate as much as we could. There's even more than we've put in the book. It was, you know, it still comes into this very day. And Mysterious Sky is the end result. And it was to further emphasis, A, that the research has been conducted in the Soviet Union for a long, long time, but also to reinforce that whatever the UFO phenomena is, it certainly doesn't recognize any political borders. And the Soviet Union was no exception. So it was for a number of reasons, and also to give credit to the researchers there. I mean, you know, your listeners are probably aware of many researchers, certainly in the United States, well-known names, but I dare say very few of them have heard of anyone from the former Soviet Union.
Well,
to get them some recognition for their hard work, because, of course, at one point, under the old Soviet regime, quite literally, for getting involved in UFO research and studying it, it cost you your life.
Sure does. Philip, we're getting a crackling line from you, so I'm going to keep talking to you for the next 10 minutes or so until we get down to the half, and then I'm going to have Tom reconnect with you and hope that we get a better line, okay?
Okay.
Now, the KGB, were they involved in many of the then-Soviet cases?
Absolutely. I mean, the KGB and the Russian military conducted the biggest UFO study ever, anywhere in the world. And it all sparked with an incident that took place on the border between the Soviets and China. It was witnessed by many of their military personnel. And so the instructions went out that all Soviet military personnel, no matter where they were, from the lowest ranking officer, you know, the squaddy.
Sure.
The GI, you would call it. We call them squaddies. To the official military brass, every single one of them were part of the project, and they had to report anything and everything they saw. And when you think of the Soviet military machine at the time, how many individual people were involved, and then it's the biggest UFO study ever conducted. And the KGB did go out and conduct interviews, mainly with the military and civilian population, more so the pilots and that kind of thing, but not exclusively. And after the fall of the Soviet Empire, of course, a lot of this material was released. It was actually a former Soviet pilot and cosmonaut who started the ball rolling and got some of the information released. And, of course, the KGB files, although we've only touched the surface, they are there. They have been translated into English, and they're in our book.
Tell us more about this Kola Peninsula area and what might have happened out there.
Well, there's one of the incidents there. I mean, it was a, you know, kind of a border. It's kind of a touchy area, like a lot of borders are. There's a lot of tension. Not a lot of activity, but a lot of looking at you and looking back and, you know, keep an eye on each other. And one evening, quite literally, a huge UFO, a glowing object, was observed at close quarters over the border. Not only was it observed at close quarters, it also affected the telecommunications of both sides, but mainly the Soviet side of things. Of course, it sent them into blind panic, you know, literally interfered with their communications. You know, they couldn't speak to each other, they couldn't speak back to the base and so on. And it was observed by certainly dozens, possibly even hundreds of individuals at the time. And it just sent the Russian military brass into absolute panic. What was this thing? And it could, you know, cut off all communications. They knew it wasn't theirs. They certainly knew it wasn't the Americans. And they certainly knew it wasn't the Chinese.
Sure. At least they hoped it wasn't ours, huh?
You know, so, you know, thought, well, we better try and find out what this is. And hence, you know, the investigation started in earnest. And they wanted to get to the bottom of it. I'm not sure they ever did, but they certainly tried.
Phil, is that the area where we've seen some film of Soviet soldiers kind of marching up to an object or a craft? Is that Kola area?
No, that's a completely different area. That was in the Ukraine, and our researchers largely dismissed that particular film as a fake.
Ah.
Unfortunately. You know, we're fortunate that we still have colleagues there in the Ukraine now who track this down, and a researcher in the U.S., who, this came out as a part of a TV podcast. He researched the television side of things. And unfortunately, you know, it came out as to be a fabrication. There was lots of loopholes in the film that only, you know, someone from Russia would sort of see instantly. There was problems with the Soviet military uniform and so on. But it is a fake, unfortunately. But it doesn't detract from the phenomena itself within the Soviet Union, because it goes back, you know, not just decades, but centuries. And not all of it, but a great deal of it is in mysterious sky.
Tell me about the Soviet scientists of the era. Were they involved in any of this, or were they hushed out?
No, well, they had to keep quiet, but they weren't allowed to speak publicly for a long, long time. But yes, they were involved. And again, it's not hearsay. I was fortunate to have two bona fide Soviet scientists, both the Academy of Sciences in Moscow, come and stay at my house in England. One was Dr. Sergei Chanov, and the other chap, I'm not sure I can pronounce his name correctly, but it was Dr. Yuli Platov. They for a living, they studied the ionosphere and the upper reaches of our atmosphere. That's what they did for a living. But they were involved in the UFO research program. They came to a conference in England. As far as I'm aware, they're the only Russian scientists ever to do that, and were allowed to speak for the first time. And they, you know, they told it a bit on the skeptical side, that the phenomena exists, but, you know, regarding the nature and the origin of it, but no doubt that it does exist nonetheless. And they gave two fascinating lectures in the UK, detailing of how they'd gone about it, how they'd been involved. They even had a thing called an all-sky camera, where they could photograph a great deal of the sky. It was almost like a great fisheye lens that could take a huge photograph of the sky. And yes, they were involved. And, you know, they weren't allowed to speak for an awful long time. And then, of course, when the barriers came down, they were. Then the language barrier, but also the financial barrier prevented it as well. I mean, these were two gentlemen who both had PhDs, you know, but they were as poor as church mice. You know, if you or I had done the same kind of profession in our respective countries, we'd have had a steady and nice living.
Yeah, absolutely. did they ever have reversed engineered equipment that you know of? Craft?
It's rumored. These two particular scientists never talked about that kind of thing, but it's long been rumored by many of the researchers and the scientists. I mean, the Soviet Union has experienced just about everything you can think of, including crashes of vehicles. And whilst we've got no concrete proof of this, it is speculated that they do have material or materials that they have tried to understand. Whether you would call that reverse engineer, I'm not entirely sure. I think I would, but certainly try to get to the bottom of it. And of course, in some of the documentation that was released, we found out that the Soviet premier at the time, back in 1947, was interested in what happened at Roswell.
Many of us have heard about the 1908 blast over Tunguska in Siberia. Some 200 million trees over 850 square miles just flattened. Did you ever investigate that, Philip, or look into that?
Absolutely. I mean, Tunguska is mentioned in one chapter in the book. I mean, it's the biggest single blast of its kind ever to take place on Earth. And, I mean, I live several thousand miles from where the blast occurred. I'm in England. But we have a photograph. The nearest city to me, if anyone knows England, is called Leeds in West Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
We have a photograph of Leeds on that particular evening in 1908, and it's like daylight. So you could even see the blast from here. That's the kind of thing. Well, it's several thousand miles away.
My God, it's huge.
Yeah. Well, the main investigator was Professor Kulik. Or Kulig, I think it was the next commander. Didn't get there for a few years. What you have to understand about the region we're talking about in Tunguska is it's a swamp-infested nowhere. There were no roads. They didn't have a helicopter pad in 1908. It took them several years before they finally got there, and they were absolutely stunned. And they still go back, scientists still go back there every year now. And, of course, the evidence is still there for all to see.
Well, do you think it was an asteroid or something else?
There are a number of theories, and we've covered most of them in the book, but there are those that believe that it was a UFO that crashed, and not an asteroid or a planetary body or a meteorite. They've never found any material from planetary bodies or astronomical bodies that would explain this. I mean, whatever that was exploded at Tunguska didn't explode on impact. It exploded a certain distance above the Earth, pretty much like an atomic bomb does. You know, an atomic bomb does not explode on impact. And that's where you get the radial pattern of the trees in the blast area, because the blast came from above, not from ground level. And some of they literally had tribesmen living in that area at the time, almost nomad-like. They saw this thing coming into the atmosphere. And one of the peculiarities about it is that it seemed to change course.
Well, see, now that an asteroid would never do.
Exactly. It seemed to change course and then explode. And, you know, one of the theories to put forward, and it is only a theory, we can't prove it at all, is that it was, you know, not of this Earth, and it was artificially made, to put it, you know, I can't put it any better than that. But it's a fascinating story in its own right. I mean, there's never been an impact on it like that in living history. And if you imagine that kind of explosion over one of the cities of the United States today, what the consequences would be.
It would wipe it out, Philip.
Absolutely.
There'd be nothing left.
Absolutely. And, you know, it would be totally devastating. It would have moved.
Millions of casualties. Let me ask you something. Is your cord loose on your phone?
It could well be.
That might be it, because you're really starting to crackle here. So we're going to see if we can, you and Tom can work something out there when we come back in just a couple of minutes. Have there ever been reports of occupants on craft in any of these Soviet cases?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing that started all this, and you have to remember, back in 1987, there was an official press release by TASS, the official Soviet press agency, that reported the landing of a UFO in Voronezh, in Russia. And not only was it the landing, this was in daylight, it also reported its occupants that were outside it. And that was a story that went around the world. The location, the site were examined by the local scientists as well as UFO researchers, and that was an official TASS press release. And one of the Western journalists who went back to TASS and said, "Are you joking? Are you having a laugh?" And TASS, their reply was, "We don't joke." Typical Soviet fashion, archetypical Soviet fashion, "We don't joke." And that's where I was then interviewed by the various Soviet newspapers that started all this. So not only do they have occupant reports, it was released by the official Soviet news agency.
And they're having abduction reports as we are in this country and as people are in the United Kingdom?
Absolutely. I mean, there's also there's the cultural difference, which seems to be the same no matter where you go in the world. Slight differences in the way people perceive the encounters, just as there are in the U.S. But they certainly are there, no doubt about it at all.
Of every case you've investigated, every one about the Soviet Union, is there one that just stands out the most for you?
There's no one that stands out. I think certain incidents stand out, not because of their nature, but it's because of the people that's reported them. They're the kind of people who have the most to lose. And, of course, that's the Soviet cosmonauts. And, again, they were silenced for many, many years, but now they've gone on the record, pretty much as Buzz Aldrin did this year for the first time, of course, and say that the Apollo astronauts on the way to the first moon landing actually observed the UFO.
And then he kind of backed down a little bit. He was a guest on my show, Philip, and he basically said, "Nah, nothing really has happened." But I don't know. There are two conflicting stories there. But with these cosmonauts, what are some of the things they said?
Well, I mean, they've been quite candid. And again, I was fortunate enough to meet one of the Soviet cosmonauts in the Republic of San Marino in Italy at a conference. And they've made it quite clear that whilst in space, usually on the Mir or one of the space stations, they have observed, artifacts that are not of this Earth. And they certainly weren't, American. And they've described them as large cylinders, illuminated. They've even taken some pictures of them. I haven't seen those pictures, but they have taken them. And, I mean, the cosmonaut I met was a hero of the Soviet Union with his medals and so on. He was on Mir. And it makes no doubt about it. They have seen things that they can't explain.
Let's talk a little bit more about that when we come back, Philip. We're going to check your lines. And let's go back to Philip Mantle. Philip, let's continue talking about the cosmonauts and some of the things that they saw up there in space.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reports we have is actually from the Mir space station. And it was the cosmonauts, and they have to excuse me, I cannot pronounce their names. I have trouble with English, never mind Russian.
But you know what? Nobody will know anyway.
Well, they were en route, quite literally, to dock with the Mir. And it was a peculiar-looking thing, but it had antenna and protrusions, they called it, but it certainly looked like antenna, certainly under its own control, certainly not of Soviet design. And it was illuminated. It had lights, and it appeared to be shadowing them, for want of a better word, certainly moving in tandem with them, in parallel with them. And they were absolutely perplexed by this thing. They were the top of the tree as far as certainly orbital spacecraft were at the time. And that's no disrespect to the U.S. And they reported it accordingly. And it was only after the fall of the Soviet authorities, the Soviet Empire, if you like, that the cosmonauts then started to speak up. And it was mainly because one of the cosmonauts came out and became interested in the subject. She was able to persuade others. And, the floodgates didn't exactly open, but they certainly began to leak. And the information slowly but surely came out. And whilst not all of them have gone on the record, and I think that's the same in the United States, certainly a number of them have, as well as, high-ranking military officials, not just the cosmonauts as well. And it's fascinating to hear it because, excuse me, when people ridicule the UFO subject, it's people like the cosmonauts. They have the most to lose by reporting this kind of thing. And so for them to go on to the record, is you know, they must believe in it themselves. And they've more to lose than, you know, than the ordinary Joe in the street, and that's no disrespect. But it makes for fascinating reading. It really does. And it's very, very difficult to dismiss. I mean, we all know that a lot of UFO sightings can be easily explained, you know.
Right.
Balloons, planets, that kind of thing. But this is in space. You know, a 747 doesn't go past you with its landing lights on in the fog, and then you make a mistake, you know.
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's that kind of thing. And when people like that start to report this kind of thing, then you've got to sit up and take notice. You really have.
Did you get any reports or did you investigate the incredible story of a UFO over Chernobyl when that event was occurring?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole point of Mysterious Sky, we look at the UFO phenomenon right back from prehistory almost, right the way up to modern-day Russia. And there were reports over Chernobyl, on and around, and afterwards, when the disaster took place, mostly seen by the local population there at the time, but certainly strange lights, strange objects seen at the time, and also even more up to date, when we have the war in Chechnya. You know, we talk about the UFO sightings over the Chechen battlefields that again have been reported by both civilian and military witnesses. But yes, there certainly were reports that came our way from on and around the time and afterwards of the Chernobyl disaster. Now, whether it was something keeping an eye on it, whether it was something to do with the panic at the time, or whether it was an after effect of the disaster, no one can be really sure. But there were certainly reports there without a question of a doubt.
Did any of them ever talk about, or were they concerned about the visitations? Did they feel threatened at all?
No, I don't think there's ever been a direct threat. I mean, that's what the military were concerned about, of course. Was this a threat? Was it a, and I'll use this in the right context, was it a foreign technology that was, you know, intending them harm? I mean, we do know a lot of the, you know, the power behind the Soviet Empire was built on paranoia and scare tactics and this kind of thing. But the reports that have come our way, there was never, ever any direct threat, either implied or assumed by any of this phenomena. It was more that it was just there for whatever reason. Didn't seem to be doing any harm, didn't seem to be hurting anyone or anything, apart from, you know, the Tunguska blast, that is. But it certainly wasn't a malevolent force at all. I mean, again, like the US, like different places around the world, there are parts of the Soviet Union, we still call it that for want of a better phrase, that seem to have a concentration of sightings. There seems to be a lot in one particular area down the years. And the locals that live there and who observe this phenomenon have sort of become accustomed to it. You know, it's not going to hurt them. It's not killing their, you know, their livestock. It's not doing any harm. It is just there. And as puzzling and sometimes frightening as it may seem, if you come upon it unexpectedly, like most people do, it actually doesn't do you any harm, and it doesn't appear to be. And it, you know, if you look around the world at some of the areas that have the strange lights, they have them in Martha in Texas, for example. They also take on their own name. The locals tend to give them their own names as well. I mean, the Aborigines in Australia, for example, call them the Min Min lights. So, but they don't do them any harm. So they certainly weren't there. You know, nothing malevolent at all.
Do you know if the Soviets were working in tandem with the United States government or even the British government as a joint effort on some of these cases?
Can't find any information that would support that at all, George. Mm. I mean, none whatsoever. I mean, you have to remember that mostly at the time, this was, you know, a closed society. It took you great difficulty to even get out of the country on holiday or on vacation or whatever. And certainly no cooperation with any other agencies outside of the Soviet Union. It was purely, you know, insular. It was all done mainly by the KGB and the military, a lot of the investigation. There were the civilian researchers tried to cooperate as best as they could, and a lot of this was underground. Certainly in the 60s and 70s, they called it, you know, the Invisible College. There were a few scientists, mainly Dr. Felix Siegel, trying to get his work out into, you know, the Western world. And a little bit of it did filter out, you know, now and again, but by no means to any great degree. And it was only really after the fall of the Soviet Empire that we could learn more about what happened there from all sources. But on an official basis, I'm not saying it didn't happen. All I'm saying is at the moment we haven't discovered that. But the files of the ministries there and the KGB are enormous. And who knows what may turn up in the future.
Were there ever any reports of government leaders talking with any of these inhabitants of these craft or anything? Like we always hear, you know, Area 51 here in the United States, we hear all kinds of bizarre things. Did you get anything like that?
Not really, no. But we know that some of the Soviet leaders were interested. Joseph Stalin, back in 1947, for example, it is known, officially known, that he wanted to find out what had happened at Roswell. Because the Roswell crash, you know, the press release went around the world. But I don't think he ever found out, but he certainly was interested, wanted to know, as did at the same time over in the UK. It made the headlines here, and just a few years later, our Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, wanted to know what all this stuff about UFOs was. That's in an official memo, you know, anyone can get access to. So it's not rumour. They were certainly interested. But whether they ever took it any further than that or partook in this type of phenomena still remains to be seen. Again, it's because of the closed nature of the society. And, you know, sticking your nose in those days and asking questions like that could quite literally mean you're off to the gulag or you just disappeared and never to return.
Why have these governments been so successful, Philip, in withholding the information, at least covering it up so that we, as people, could never find out what was going on?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people have often asked me, is there a cover-up? And I would have to say, yes, there is. I mean, it's easy to prove. Cover-up means the withholding of information for whatever purpose. And it's easily provable. I mean, colleagues of mine in the UK, for example, have only found out in these last few years that we had a secret department back in the 1950s. You know, the UFO Working Party, as I believe, or the Flying Saucer Working Party, it was called at that time. That, you know, down in Whitehall in London, studying UFOs officially. You know, this weren't a bunch of clerks who did it in their spare time. This wasn't officially. Again, it had been rumoured on and off, but there was no proof. Now, it's only up until these last couple of years that we didn't have the Freedom of Information Act. We did not have one. And when that was released, of course, this information then, you know, started to leak out. And so why they keep it secret, I don't know. I mean, the obvious thing is that we are being visited by extraterrestrials, and they don't want the population to know for whatever reason, for political and social reasons, I mean a whole host of reasons. It could well be that the powers that be, including ours and the US and the Soviet Union, are as baffled as the rest of us by the UFO phenomenon, and no major power would ever want to admit that they don't know what's flying around in their skies, that they don't not control their own airspace. Or it could just be red tape. You know, the nature of government is red tape, and things do get covered. I mean, it's the Official Secrets Act in the UK, that's what we have. It covers all things supposedly secret. And it's an official secret, for example. This is how ridiculous it goes to know how many tea bags they use in the House of Commons in Parliament. That's how ridiculous it is. But that is just red tape. I mean, a friend of mine signed the Official Secrets Act because he worked in a textile mill. And they used to make the textiles for the dress uniforms in the military. They still had to sign the Official Secrets Act. It worked in a textile mill, for heaven's sake. You know, that's how far-reaching it is. It's ludicrous.
Let's go back to the beginning of what you were able to uncover in terms of visitations over the Soviet Union, Russia. How far back? Thousands of years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, because of the country it is, it has, and this is not, again, no disrespect to the United States, the US, we still look in terms of being a new country. You know, it is the new country,
of
it's
course.
The new world. But certainly in Europe and the Soviet Union is no different. You know, the population, they go back, you know, centuries. And in the folklore of the country and the ancient manuscripts, the visitations, the sightings, the UFOs go back right through history. It's not a modern phenomenon. Whatever the UFO phenomena is, George, it certainly didn't sort of spring to life with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947. although we put that as the modern era of the subject, of course. But it certainly goes back through history, and with recordings, because of the type of country that Russia was and became, they were ruled by the Tsars, the ruling royal family. Of course, they go back many decades. So, documents and historical records were kept, and stories were written in various languages and books and manuscripts, and they are there. Again, it was mainly the language barrier that prevented a lot of this coming to the surface, but it's there. And there are UFO sightings and encounters with otherworldly beings going back centuries, and certainly not a modern phenomenon by any stretch of the imagination.
Did they ever theorize that they might have thought that humans were genetically altered? Were there any reports written in old Russian manuscripts or texts or anything like that?
Absolutely. I mean, they almost echo the biblical story of Adam and Eve. One gentleman said to me, to him, Adam and Eve looks like a genetic experiment. Piece of one person and you make another one. It was cloning, if want of a better word, but you didn't make a replica, you made another person. And there are this kind of stories, again, in the old folklore texts throughout the Soviet Union of this, and also the type of beings that were radically different in certainly in appearance to the Soviets at the time. And, the fair-skinned, pretty-looking, fair-haired people, which... not just in that particular area, but throughout Russia and Scandinavia. We give them the nickname of the Nordics, of course. But it's absolutely no question about that at all.
Did the reports of the craft change at all over the years, or did they stay the same? The kinds of craft that were out there?
I think they've only changed in modern times, to be honest, George. They were pretty standard. They were pretty much the same as have been reported throughout history here. The discs or the shields.
Yeah.
Or the glowing lights, or the tubes, or cigar shapes. The pattern is there just because it was the Soviet Union. As we said right at the beginning, whatever the UFO subject is, it certainly doesn't take any notice of international borders. And that was, the Soviet Union was no different whatsoever, be it today or be it 500 years ago. And, the cylinders, the shiny wheels in the sky, all this kind of thing.
Tell me a little bit about Plexkin and what we know about this individual.
So that, I didn't quite catch the name then.
Was it Plexkin? What is that?
I don't recognize the name.
Plaksin? It says A. Plexkin. Said something about secret Soviets and they're trying to hide some programs.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't recognize the name because there's lots of them in the Soviet Union.
Right. No, I understand.
It was great putting that manuscript through the spell checker, I can assure you.
And I might not even be pronouncing his name right.
But, yeah, I mean, again, it's rumored, I think I hear on one of your intros, like, Area 51 in the U.S., it's rumored that in parts of certainly modern-day Russia, they have their own equivalent of Area 51. Perhaps not on as large a scale, perhaps not as big or anything of that nature, but it's certainly there. And I met a chap in America, although he's from Russia, just 3 years ago, and he made it quite clear that they, as far as he's concerned, he's a Russian. He claims to work for the Russian government now. It's a claim that's disputed, but he showed his documents that they have a facility there that's not too dissimilar to Area 51, but not, like I said, not as large. And pretty much the same kind of thing takes place, that they have captured alien technology, for want of a better phrase, and there are a number of individuals, scientists, Soviet scientists, Russian scientists, working there. And I don't know if your listeners remember a colleague of mine who sadly died just a couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago, a chap by the name of Graham Birdsall. Graham used to run and edit UFO magazine in the UK. And Graham was all set, was in negotiations with this particular chap to go to Russia to see this site, to visit it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, sadly, Graham died, very unexpectedly.
Oh, sad.
And, the invitation, I mean, I was there when the invitation was made. Graham interviewed this chap and published the interview in UFO magazine detailing this particular location, and he was set to go. So, again, the rumour is there. I have no doubt that the actual facility exists now. Whether it's got these experiments being conducted there is a different argument. But it would certainly be an interest. I mean, Graham was a great big bluff man. I'm sure he would have made himself known when he got there, one way or another. But we'll have to wait and see. We will have to wait and see. You know, more research is ongoing as we speak.
You know, some say that the Germans had UFO technology. That's why they were so ahead at the time during World War II. We were fortunate enough to, have the ability to beat them. But that they had this ability and that their scientists were working on it. And that's why, of course, the Soviets at the time and us both benefited with the German scientists for our own individual space programs.
Absolutely. I mean, Operation Paperclip. After the war, you know, the spoils of war were many and varied. But one of those spoils was, you know, the German scientists. We know Wernher von Braun went to the U.S., but the Soviets got their pick as well of the German scientists.
And I'm sure they got good ones too, right?
Yeah, I don't think they treated them as well as perhaps the Americans did, but they certainly took them. There's two rumors here that you can work on. Is one that the technology we see was purely invented by the German scientists, nothing else. It was their technology that had worked on over the years.
Which is possible.
Or B, that the technology was not theirs, but they'd got it from elsewhere, i.e. from extraterrestrials, one way or another, but they had adapted it, reverse engineered it, or were trying to do that, hadn't quite succeeded. And of course, the war ended, and the US and the Soviet took over where the Germans left off, taking the scientists with them, of course, who had worked on it. And I tried to track a chap down here in the UK, I mean, in the country of Wales here. It's known as the valleys. There's lots of small little valleys and little rural areas. And he was from Poland. He was a Polish immigrant who had settled here after the war. And he claimed to have worked at one of these establishments making a flying saucer.
Let's see what he says.
For the Germans.
When we come back, Philip, I'll ask you about him. Philip, tell us more about this individual from Poland who claims that he was helping to make UFO craft. He sounds a little bit like the United States' version of Bob Lazar.
I don't think he was quite on Bob's level. I have a colleague of mine by the name of Margaret Fry. Now, Margaret lived in Wales. A well-known and active UFO researcher was Margaret. And I was staying with Margaret for a few days, and she told me the story of a Polish immigrant who lived in the valleys of Wales. Now, Margaret had personally interviewed him, and he said that during the Second World War, he was at a forced labor camp, but not one of these huge, great, big things like the concentration camps. This was a small forced labor camp where he was an engineer, but not high tech. This was a nuts and bolts kind of engineering chap, and he'd been forced to work there. And one of the things that they'd actually built was a flying saucer, you know, the typical type of thing, the domed disc. But it wasn't, you know. Weird technology. It was purely man-made technology. It certainly was nuts and bolts, and it had an engine and that kind of thing. The location of which I never managed to get from Margaret, and he worked there throughout the Second World War. He was captured when the Germans invaded Poland, and forced to work there under extreme conditions. So we set off to try and find him again in some of the small rural communities. I can't remember his name now, but I know the type of name it was because my stepfather is Polish. And whilst there were a number of individuals confirmed he was there, he lived locally, they couldn't quite remember where he lived. He was an old chap by this time, and he was a bit of a chameleon. He tended to blend into the background. He was a local character, if you like. But he was certainly there. There was no question about it. He'd moved from one village to another. After the war, like my stepfather did, he went down the coal mines, used his engineering skills in that respect. That particular area of Wales had nothing but mines. You know, it was a coal mining community. And so he was known by some of his ex-colleagues, spoke to a couple of them, and they remembered him. They knew who he was, but he'd moved on to another village. And he'd worked down the mines with them, and they told us the story that, you know, he told them exactly the same, that, you know, there was him and a number of others, you know, a small group of men worked in difficult conditions, but they worked on a flying saucer. He would probably call it more of a kind of a blacksmith type of engineer, nuts and bolts, you know, steel, girders, rivets, that kind of thing, but they certainly built one. And it flew. You know, there was no question that it was just left there in a hangar or, you know, somewhere. It did fly. What it was used for, what they were doing with it, etc., they weren't party to that kind of information. You know, they were literally slave labour. But a fascinating story, nonetheless. And I'm just sorry I didn't get the chance to speak to him in person, but I certainly tried. It's a very rural community, and they look on outsiders like me with an air of suspicion anyway.
Sure. How well
fortunate that Margaret lived in the area, and she was able to speak. She interviewed him. Margaret did interview the chap in question. But it's a fascinating a side issue to the whole UFO subject. It really is.
How well did it fly, Philip? Do you know?
I don't know. All I knew is that it was capable of flying. It did take off. It was manned by, you know, the German officers at the time, and it did take off. It flew. To what degree, to what capability, no idea. They weren't allowed to know. You know, they did their job, asked no questions, and were just grateful to get some food at the end of the day. And that was it.
Did they have any native legends in that region of the world?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, back in the Soviet Union, they do. There's certainly legends there of the you know, the heavenly spaceships or heavenly saucers or heavenly vehicles, whatever you want to call them, going back throughout time. But that particular area of Germany we were talking about at the time, I'm not sure, but they certainly did in the Soviet Union. Yes, absolutely.
And did they again talk of landings and abductions and things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a thing in folklore in the UK. It's not that old, going back to, you know, a couple of hundred years, 200-300 years, where we had the fairy lore. We had the fairy folk, not the little pretty people with the wings and the nice clothes. They were radically different to that. And they lived in fairy mounds. And, of course, when you went the next day, the fairy mound wasn't there. And when you went in the fairy mound, it was illuminated by strange lights, but there were no lanterns. And the creatures, they actually interbred with humans and produced the changeling, half fairy, half
strange
human, which is an exact replica of the kind of things we're told today by the abductees. You know, they go in a flying saucer that is illuminated, but there's no lights, there's no light bulbs, there's no light fittings, you know, and of course it's a flying saucer, it's not there the next day, and the offspring are half human, half alien. And it's the same around the world in the ancient texts that we find and the folklore and the manuscripts. There are these stories, and Russia is no exception.
These are incredible things that are happening, Philip.
Absolutely. I mean, again, you know, the skeptics will try and write it off as, you know, some kind of paranoia. Certainly in modern times where people are wanting to hit the headlines for whatever reason, you know, what they're wanting their, you know, 15 minutes of fame, I found that to be quite the opposite. And, of course, if we look back through folklore and ancient lore, even some of the religious manuscripts that we all, you know, even the Bible and other manuscripts tell of these strange beings that they're not necessarily of a, you know, divine origin. And I don't mean to disrespect anyone's religious beliefs, but it's another way of interpreting it. They are there and cannot be dismissed.
Tell me about what the Russians were talking about, why they were so concerned about so-called clouds.
Well, the thing that sparked the KGB into life, of course, was this huge object over the border there. And it was illuminated. It looked like a huge cloud, but it wasn't a cloud. The cloud is the shape it was. And that sparked the interest. And, you know, this cloud, it wasn't a cloud. It was solid. This thing was self-illuminated under self-control. Were also witnessed to a lesser or greater degree in other parts of the country. So they obviously wanted to know, was it the same thing? Was it connected to this? What on earth was it doing? What did it want? What was its purpose? What was its origin? And, again, no government of any nature would want to allow this to happen without knowing what it was, even more so than the Soviet powers. They wanted to know everything about everybody, virtually, and, you know, there's this phenomenon in their airspace, which is you know, poking fun at them, if you like. It's waving at them and saying, there's nothing you can do about it, we're here, and they wanted to know. And, of course, like any government, if this is alien technology, let's assume it is for sake of argument, well, can we have it, please? Can we use that to our best advantage? You know, we've got enemies around the world, or perceived enemies anyway, and if we can capture and learn something from this, then perhaps we can put it to good use.
Did they ever theorize, Philip, where they might be coming from, what planet system, whether another dimension? Did they talk about that?
They've not talked about another dimension or a particular region in space or another planet, but just that it was not of this Earth, and it was not man-made. I mean, the cosmonauts, certainly with some of their sightings, they were, you know, bang up to date with the latest space technology, you know, be it Soviet or be it Russia. I mean, the Americans never make any secret of the stuff they're sending into space, just as perhaps what they're doing. But certainly the vehicles that fly into space is the space shuttle. You can't hide it, you know. Whatever was flying around outside their vehicle wasn't the space shuttle.
Now, did they have a relationship with their other branches of their military? Yeah, you know, as we have, the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force, the Army.
Absolutely. Every single one of them, whether you were the cook, you know, or whether you were the top brass, you were involved. It was your duty to report this incident or any incidents that you came across.
Pilots, too?
Everybody.
All right.
Absolutely everybody. There was no exceptions. And if you think about it, I'm talking man for man. The Soviet military forces at the time probably had more people in their military than any other army anywhere in the world. You know, probably millions of them, you know, from the clerk in the office to the general, you know, and everyone in between. And every single one of them were under instructions to report anything and everything they saw. And they did. You know, absolutely. But not only that, the KGB also interviewed civilian airline pilots. And there's a fascinating report from the KGB files, and it's verbatim, it's word for word, it's not paraphrased. You know, it's a transcript of the interview with the pilots and the UFOs they saw whilst en route from, you know, Murmansk to wherever. And, you know, so they took it just wider than the military. When reports came in from other areas, they were obviously monitoring it and keeping their eye open. They looked into some of that as well. But every single military person in the Soviet Union, the whole of the Soviet Union, not just Russia, the whole of the Soviet Union took part in the biggest UFO study there has ever been. And none of us in the West knew one thing about it until afterwards.
And what were the results, Philip?
UFOs are certainly there. And as far as some of the individuals were concerned, those that made the sightings, including some of the cosmonauts, this was not of this Earth. This was not man-made technology. It wasn't balls of plasma and gas, which do exist, I do believe, but it doesn't explain the UFO phenomenon. This is something beyond their control.
What is your personal take in all of this?
Well, if you look at the UFO subject as a whole, rather than any one individual incident or report, I kind of have, you know, a little list. We can't prove conclusively that it's one thing or another. There's evidence. You have to weigh up what that evidence is. Like you go to court, George, and you present your evidence, and the jury then decides what that represents.
Sure.
And the same as the UFO is there with the UFO phenomena. We can prove beyond the shadow of a doubt it is there. So we have a few theories, if you like. One, the most popular, is that the UFO phenomena is extraterrestrial. It is literally nuts and bolts vehicles going from A to B. One way or another, whether it's through a dimension, through a wormhole,
or sure.
Just, you know, putting rocket fuel in of some kind, you know, or whether it's Star Trek technology that gets them here, but they come.
But they're getting here.
But they're here. Another is that what we are witnessing is some kind of I think it's called the Federal Hypothesis. It's kind of fallen away over the last few years, but we're looking at secret military technology. It's got nothing to do with aliens or anything from anywhere else. It is the powers that be experimenting. And of course, the perfect cover-up is to call it a flying saucer from Mars, and everybody walks away laughing and joking and takes no notice of it whatsoever. So that is one idea. In the UK, and I think it's predominantly in the UK and Europe rather than in America, the idea is that we are looking at balls of light that are made by the Earth. The phenomenon of earthquake lights is well known. When there's an earthquake, there's kind of a glow of lights rather than balls of plasma. But certain locations around the world, I mentioned Marfa in Texas, we have the Pennine Hills of the north of England, and various other locations, the Hest Island valleys of Norway, seem to have these lights in great profusion. They're not just now, they go back decades, they go back centuries. They've always been there. The theory is, and it's been largely put forward by Michael Persinger in Canada, Dr. Michael Persinger, that when you get too close to these lights, they are electrically charged, and it basically muddles your brain. It scrambles your brains.
Permanently?
Yeah, not permanently, temporarily.
All right.
You can still function. You can still, you know, walk, talk, drive the car, but you have I call it an hallucination for want of a better word, but it's not an hallucination in its strictest sense. But you have an otherworldly experience, and you interpret that experience in the technology of the day and the folklore of the day. So today we have aliens in spaceships. 200 years ago we had fairies. You know, 1,000 years ago it would have been, you know, armies in
right.
the sky.
And it could have been
2,000 years ago it would have been, you know, heavenly chariots, whatever.
All the same.
But it's all the same, but you just interpret it in the technology of that particular era. And it's an interesting idea, but I'm not sure I believe it can explain some things, but not the whole lot. Because what that theory does, of course, it rules out the photographs. We have good photographs of structured objects, not balls of light. We have pictures of balls of light as well, of course.
Sure.
But we have photographs of structured craft vehicles. Now, those vehicles are either our own, somebody here on Earth has built them, you know, put rivets in them and an engine and flown them, or they're not ours. They come from off-planet. And it's really down to those two. And you have to judge the evidence yourself, weigh it up for yourself, and come to your own conclusion.
You mentioned how Stalin was trying to get to the moon with his spacecraft program. And was that done with, again, captured or crashed alien material?
No, this was certainly Soviet material, nothing else. It was certainly so, and they were, we have to remember they were in the lead in the space race for an awful long time. But it was the political machinations of the Soviet Union that prevented manned landings on the moon before the Americans. A lot of internal politics and arguments and so on. But it was purely, Russian scientific technology that launched the space race and ultimately lost it, thankfully.
Isn't it amazing, Philip, how when you think of it, that you try to think that the West does not lose at anything it does, that it stays miles ahead of everyone. But you are right, because back in the 50s and into the 60s until we really got going with our Apollo program, the Russians were ahead of us.
Oh, absolutely. And not only ahead, they were miles ahead. But when you look at the political structures of the two regimes at the time, it's only then you can see why the Russians failed and the Americans succeeded. The Russians were under such pressure, it was, succeed at all costs. And we've learned in recent years that the Apollo program was risky at times. You know, sometimes it was on a little bit of a wing and a prayer, and things did go wrong. But then you look at the Soviet Union, and they went completely the other way. I mean, if Apollo had failed, George, no one would have lost their head. If the Russians failed, they literally did. There was the difference, and they took huge risks and failed.
And
it was that, because of the pressure they were under, the political and propaganda pressure to succeed before the West, and they failed to do it. Had they taken a little bit more time and a little bit more care, they probably could have won. But, it was just the political setup at the time. The two differences were huge, and, of course, you could argue that good overcame the bad, but that's a different argument. But it was certainly the differences in the political setup that overcame that.
Have any Soviet officials ever come forward to back up some of these stories?
Absolutely. I mean, in one of the intros I heard on your show, you'd previously interviewed George Knapp.
Yes.
From the U.S. Now, George was fortunate, and I've corresponded with George about this, to go to the Soviet Union and interview many of these officials. And has them on camera. And they'll sit there in their military uniform, quite unabashed, and tell you exactly what happened. Where it happened. I mean, this is not an old retired uniform that's falling apart. They're still there.
Still there.
Still part of the Soviet military machine.
And they're not making up these stories.
Absolutely not. And I mean, again, they've more to lose than they have to gain by doing this. And, and George will confirm that. And George has made his own TV shows, and they're there. And they've taken him to the locations where the various incidents took place. And the general will sit there and look at the camera and say, yeah, and it'll even draw you what he saw. This big cylinder with the protrusions and that kind of thing. And we mentioned some of this in the book, of course. So, yes, without a question, these are not, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and, General so-and-so may have said this or may have said that. They're on the record. They are on the record.
Why won't ours go on the record?
Well, again, it's the, I believe it's down to the different cultures. I mean, some of them will. Few and far between, I admit, but some of them will. I mean, the biggest UFO incident ever to happen in the UK was at Rendlesham College.
Oh, yeah. Huge case.
Absolutely, in 1980. And, of course, it was many years. I mean, it was an American air base here in the UK. And it took a long time for the deputy base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Holt, to go on the record, but he did. I've been fortunate enough to meet Colonel Holt, and he will tell you in no uncertain terms. He was called from a dinner one evening just after Christmas in 1980. There'd been a UFO landing in the forest the night before. They told him it was back again. He took a party of American military personnel into the forest. He observed these things, with beams of light coming down from, almost like laser beams coming down. This was a nuclear facility. This had nuclear weapons. You know, he was the second in command on the base, the deputy base commander. So it took a few years. I think Colonel Holt waited until he retired from the Air Force before he went on the record. But he has done so on numerous occasions since. So there are some brave enough to do that, or they feel strongly enough that, you know, the public should know these things.
Let's find out in a second, Philip, if there's any evidence, hard evidence out there, traces, material. And then we'll talk about the alien autopsy footage. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Where's the hard evidence, Philip? So many of these great cases. Do we get anything? Do we have traces of anything left behind?
Absolutely. I mean, it depends what you class as hard evidence, but it is certainly there. We briefly mentioned the Rendlesham incident here in the UK in 1980, for example. And one of the things that Colonel Holt and his party did when they went out into the forest at night, bearing in mind this object had landed there the night before, is they took a Geiger counter with them. And at the same time, Colonel Holt took a dictaphone with him, a portable one. And he's released that tape, and you can hear them talking, and they get to the landing site, and you can hear the Geiger counter clicking away. And whilst it wasn't a dangerous amount of radiation was there, it was certainly over and above the normal background you would expect. And then a few years after that, the photographs of the site appeared. And there is, you know, exactly as the airman described it, there's the three landing marks where this thing was in the forest. So you've got, you know, radiation that was only there in that one place, nowhere else. And the landing marks as well, and that's just one example of many, you know, around the world. And so, you know, what more do you want? There's innumerable photographs that have stood the test of time, not just from the United States, but, again, around the world. And more common, of course, today is videotape of one form or another. And, again, you know, the video cameras are so becoming so cheap these days that a lot of people have them, and, hey, presto, we have the UFOs on video. So there's a huge amount of evidence that simply cannot be ignored.
Tell me about the cover of your book, Mysterious Sky. What is this photograph?
That's a photograph from an area within the Soviet Union. It's a daylight UFO photograph. The original was in black and white. The publishers just added a little bit of color for purely cosmetic.
A little digital enhancement, I guess.
Yeah, they've just added some color. It's not detracted from the actual photograph. And when you see the original photograph, it's a typical, you know, grey-looking Eastern Bloc city, town. And a local resident, you know, snapped a flying saucer. So we just thought it would emphasize the whole UFO phenomenon in the Soviet Union with the buildings in the background and so on. And when we put it on the front cover, we're not saying it's fake, we're not saying it's real. It was you know, sent in to us, and we've just used it as an illustration of the type of thing we're talking about. It kind of sums things up, really.
The building looks like an apartment complex because it looks like some bed sheets are out there drawing in the wind.
Absolutely. You know, you don't see that in many places, but it certainly did at that point in time in Russia. You know, a typical Eastern Bloc town and a standard camera, nothing fancy, nothing sophisticated, black and white, not color. At that time, you know, color film was a luxury in Russia, certainly for most of the population anyway. So it was black and white, and you know, hey presto, there it is.
Tell us about the case where we're over Siberia, the Ashimba area. You talk about fighter jets destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, again, we cannot prove this. I mean, it's one of the incidents that's come our way. But, I mean, one of the things the Soviet military are famed for is the mixed fighters. I mean, they're well-respected or well-feared, whichever way you want to look at that, around the world. I mean, they are, you know, state-of-the-art fighters, or they certainly were for their time. And it was rumoured at that particular time that the MiGs, you know, the fighters were sent to intercept this particular object, and you know, they didn't come back. You know, they didn't disappear. They were destroyed. And you know, reports of this nature are few and far between, but they're certainly not unheard of. I mean, we've had them from other parts of the world as well. Even here in the UK, there's an incident where you know, a fighter was supposed to track a thing over the ocean, or you know, out over the waters around the UK, and it never came back. And similar incidents have happened in various parts of the world as well. But we put incidents like this in to emphasise the whole phenomena. We haven't cherry picked what we think would best support the evidence or best support this. You know, we've put a wide range of the types of incidents that are reported to us and to the UFO researchers in Russia to emphasise that, you know, the whole plethora of UFO sightings and this type of thing as well. You know, we've talked about earlier that perhaps, you know, the UFOs are not perceived as a threat, but maybe there may be a little bit of a threat there as far as the military is concerned, hence their interest. If there's only ever one incident like this took place, no matter where in the world, then they would perceive it as a threat, surely. I mean, it would be the obvious thing to do. It's an interesting thing, but it's one of those tantalizing kind of reports that we just can't prove. You know, we don't have the evidence. That, you know, we have the eyewitnesses and we've got testimony, but we've no proof. You know, I can't give you the cockpit of the MiG that's you know, been blasted apart or you know, the death certificate of the pilots or anything like that. But it's just an interesting anecdote, but it's by no means on its own.
I have an opportunity to know quite well now the producer of the Fox television show that presented the alien autopsy film years ago. I know him well. He told me that the film in the Fox show was a hoax. What's your take?
Absolutely. I mean, you're speaking about Bob Kiviat?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you just the background to the story to begin with. In 1993, I was the press officer for the British UFO Research Association.
Okay.
And I was contacted by a chap called Ray Santilli.
Here we go.
He said, you know, would you be interested in helping with a documentary? Didn't mention the content of it at that time. And I said, well, yeah, maybe. And over a few more phone calls, he went on to tell me that he claimed to have film of Roswell. Not Roswell, but he called it Roswell to begin with. And not only that, the aliens were being dissected on the table in front of our very eyes. So I said, well, that's great. You know, show us it, basically. Show me. Yes, I can. No, I can't. Yes, I can. No, I can't. This went on for about a year and a half.
Oh, my God. At what point were you starting to lose the...
I'd lost interest. I told him to go away politely. It was just another story on the telephone.
And he never went away.
No, I briefly met him once in London in between all this. And he again told me the story where he'd met this military cameraman whilst scouting for a rock and roll vintage film in the US, bought some, you know, an old clip of Elvis and said, well, you know, I have the Roswell. And he went and looked at it and bought it, you know, paid cash for it. And I said, well, show me it, you know, just show me it. So in early 1995, I'd got his business card and I was actually sent the Paul Davids movie of Roswell for review. It'd come out on video here. And I thought, I'll ring this Santilli chap just to see if he still claims to have this film. And he says, yes, Philip, but you don't believe me. Well, I can't believe you till you show me it. So that day I made an appointment to go to his office, went there in around about March time of 95 with my wife, and he showed me the film. I didn't see it all in one go. Over the next couple of months, he showed me there are two separate autopsy films. Only one has ever been shown on TV. There's a piece of so-called tent footage, and there is some wreckage, some debris. He showed me it all. And I said then and then, once I'd seen the film, I now knew there was film. I was also Bufora's conference organizer. I had a conference organized later that year, the August, where the two Russian scientists that I mentioned were actually coming to speak. And I said, will you show it at the conference? Didn't expect him to say yes. And he said, yes, if you'll help me investigate it. We shook hands, and that was it. Couple of months later, again, you know, very little was known about it to the outside world. I was contacted by a friend of mine who was a journalist. And he was doing a small piece about our upcoming conference, and he's asking me who the speakers were. And I'm telling the Russians, first Russian scientists, so on, with people from Africa and Scandinavia. And I said, oh, by the way, Ray Santilli, Daily Autopsy film. Briefly, I mean, a brief. He wrote an article for a local newspaper. I was then contacted by a press agency who'd seen this. They asked me a few more questions, and then the story went around the world, quite literally. The phone was ringing, the faxes were coming. They could find myself, but it just said Ray Santilli, London businessman. They couldn't find him.
He was hiding?
No, they just, because it just mentioned his name, not his business.
Okay.
So they just couldn't locate him, so I just passed the vast majority of the media contacts on to Ray, and that's where the story all started. One of the reasons I invited him to show it at the conference was not purely to sell the tickets, but I knew there and then that if we could get this film out into the open, then and only then would we try and get to the bottom of it. You know, someone may come forward and say, that's my grandfather in there, he told me about that, it's real.
Sure.
Or alternatively, I'm one of the actors, I'm the sound man, I'm the cameraman, we've filmed it at a location, at a studio here, I bought the props for it. So one way or the other, none of those things happened. I mean, nothing. So it was investigated around the world, and whilst it was argued, and a lot of people said, yes, it's real, or yes, it's fake, no one could prove anything one way or the other. Then about the late 1990s, a chap sent me an email saying, I know something about the alien autopsy film. And he was called Keith Goodyear, and I phoned Keith, gave me a phone number, and I phoned him. And he said, I know something about the tent footage. Now, the tent footage has never been shown on television. It's a small few minutes of film, and you see a creature laid out on a slab with a white cover on, two men in white coat the other side, with their faces showing, I must add, handling flesh, you know, giblets, innards, whatever you want to call it. And a dark figure moves in front of the camera from time to time. The camera's static, and it's poor quality. And he said, I know who made it. And he said it was made by AK Music in Milton Keynes in England. We tracked them down, and they said, yeah, we did. We made that. We made the tent footage part of it. But Ray Santilli said, yeah, but I gave them film, and there was nothing on it, and they made it up. You know, they pulled a stunt on him. So that set the seeds of doubt big time. That particular tent footage was exposed on Bob's show, World's Greatest Hoaxes. And he had one of the actors there, and, you know, he was actually one of the technicians that worked for AK Music called Elliot. You know, you could see his face and so on. So we knew we were on to a winner. We fully expected the Santilli House of Cards to fall down any time, but it didn't. You know, the owners of AK Music went in a national newspaper here and told the story. Nothing else. Then about 3 years ago, I wrote another article about the alien autopsy film for UFO magazine in the UK. And I leave my address at the end of my email, and again, I got an email. I know something about the alien autopsy film. This time it was a chap called Simon. So I spoke to Simon, and, you know, he said, I didn't know there was any interest in this anymore. Bearing in mind, there hadn't been the blockbuster TV shows like Bob's Alien Autopsy, Fact or Fiction. And I pointed out that, yes, there was still a lot of interest, but mainly in the UFO press or in the internet and that kind of thing. And he said, well, it was a friend of mine that actually made the dummies. He made the dummies for Ray Santilli. Would anybody be interested?
Oh, my.
So I finally met Simon at a place in Manchester.
Did you believe
him? A friend of mine called Tim Matthews. It sounded like it was more than a friend. It sounded like it was a family member or perhaps an in-law, but certainly more than just an ordinary friend. And at that time, he wouldn't tell us this chap's name. So I put Simon in touch with Bob Kiviat in the States, and this particular man had a business manager. Proper business manager. Now, we'd been looking for a special effects expert, but he wasn't. He was actually a sculptor whose work from time to time had landed himself in the film and TV world, but he was basically a sculptor. Now, Simon, over the next few months, gave me a few hints as to who this man was. He'd worked on a very popular TV show in the UK. So I managed to find a name for him, but Bob, by this time, had spoken to his business manager and had signed a confidentiality agreement. So Bob wasn't allowed to say anything, which I totally agree with.
Sure.
The idea behind it, Bob wanted to expose it worldwide on TV. You know, they were trying to negotiate a contract.
Right.
Bob just couldn't get the networks in America interested. So I found this guy's name, but I couldn't get it verified. And then last year, last year, we'd heard rumours that Santilli was making a movie. I'd heard that the year before as well, because an old boss of mine, one of her friends, still worked in the industry, in the movie industry. So we got rumours that Santilli was making a movie. Now, I found out who the movie company was that was making it. It turned out to be correct. They were making a film. And it was simply called Alien Autopsy. I don't think it ever made it to the United States. It showed here recently this year.
It might have.
It might have. Well,
it might have, I think.
So basically, I contacted the company. I spoke to the producer. He wouldn't tell me anything. But I got into an email conversation with one of the executives at the company. They were called QWERTY Films, small company in London. And it was a lady, and we were exchanging emails. I told her I was writing a book about the Alien Autopsy film, that had been involved with it from day one. And I said, as an off-the-cuff remark, I said, one of the chapters I have in the book is all from the special effects industry, most of whom believe it's a fake. Who's doing your special effects for the movie? And she said, it's a gentleman by the name of John Humphreys, and he made the fakes for Lorraine Santilli.
Huh.
And that was the name I had, so she verified it. Unknowing to her, she verified it.
Yeah.
She assumed that everybody knew it was a fake. But, of course, they didn't. So, you know, I tracked down John's website. He is who he says he is. You know, he's quite capable of doing this. He'd worked in the movies on and off down the years. You know, it was from the Royal College of Sculpting and what have you. And I told Bob I'd found his name. And Bob, you know, I think he almost fell on the floor when I told him on the telephone. And, of course, earlier this year, Santilli came out after the movie was released, of course, with another version of events, saying that the film you see on you know, Alien Autopsy, Fact or Fiction, he called it, they'd restored it. You know, he tried to say they'd restored the film. He tried to claim that when he got the film, it had been deteriorated and they had to restore it. But it wasn't. It's a fake. You know, it's plain and simple. It is a fake. John Humphreys told Bob Kiviat the whole story, lock, stock and two smoking barrels, how they'd faked it, how they'd made it, and it was only the fact that Bob couldn't get a TV deal at the time that stopped us exposing it before Santilli came out with his new version of events.
Yeah, exactly. Bob did want to go back to Fox, for example.
Absolutely.
And expose it, but yeah. I guess they weren't interested
in it. It's a fake. You know, it's 100% fake. I mean, even John Humphreys himself has released a couple of Polaroids where you see him making the dummies, you know, the original dummies. He's using a substance there to make it. And I have a friend here who's worked in the movies and TV special effects all his life, you know, even worked on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He's so good. And he's verified the techniques that we use, and yes, that's exactly how it was done. It's a fake, you know, end of the story. And, we're still trying to get, you know, to all the nitty-gritty, they all cross the T's and dot the I's, but unfortunately, it's bit the dust.
I didn't believe it when I first saw it.
Well, I neither believed it or disbelieved it. I tried to play along with Ray Santilli in the hope that we'd learn more. And I hoped and fully expected that once the film was shown around the world on television, as it was, that someone would come forward and tell us something. Of course, they never did. And, you know, from an investigation point of view, whether, you know, believing, no disrespect, wasn't good enough for me. I wanted to prove it one way or the other. If it was real, then try and prove it to be real. If it was fake, then try and prove it. Not, you know, say it is, but prove it. And I just followed the leads as they came in. You know, we some people said, oh, it's made in Brazil. I mean, I contacted people in Brazil. I got threatened with lawsuits. Because I said to this chap, did you fake it? And he got lost in translation somewhere, as if I was accusing him, and I wasn't. I was just told, and he said no. I mean, literally, as we speak, I got an email just this week from a chap who I don't know, and I'm trying to chase it up, claiming that the contract to make the fake dummies were initially put to an American company who either turned it down or it was too expensive. And I'm just trying to get that verified. As we speak, that email came in only this week. I'm just glad that we've got to the bottom of it, you know, and I know the guy at AK Music who faked the tent footage, for example, is called Keith Bateman.
Well, it's important to weed some of this stuff out because, you know, the truth, again, is, I think, scarier than the fiction. And I'm glad we were able to do that as a media and everything else. Philip, we'll be back with you final hour. We'll take phone calls now for our special guest, Philip Mantle, on Coast to Coast AM. Philip, where do you get the book, Mysterious Sky? How do you find it?
Quite simple. It's on Amazon.
Simple as that. They have everything.
Sorry?
They have everything.
Well, I would hope so.
Let's go to the phones. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Philip Mantle on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Mark Center. I'm Philip's website guy.
Oh, okay.
And I just wanted to throw my props out to Philip for the one keeping the alien autopsy story alive for 12 years. Without him, we wouldn't have gotten this far. And I did want to ask Philip, he knows I'm a stickler on the physical, and you say you have a couple of photos of the original dummy, and I was wondering if those look good.
Good evening, Mark. Nice to speak to you. How's the shoulder?
I haven't gone in for the surgery yet, but it should be a couple more days.
Okay. The photos I was referring to, Mark, were on the documentary that Sky One did. There are a couple of Polaroids. There's about three of them laid together, and it shows you John Humphreys making the original dummy. He made it out of a clay mold, and that's how he made the original dummy. Those are John Humphreys' original pictures. And I checked with my friend who worked on Lord of the Rings and various other productions, a lot of horror movies he worked on, and he said they'd made molds exactly the same way when they did dummies for various special effects. So it's exactly how you would do it, Mark. So there is physical evidence there. You know as well as I do, Mark, and I've confirmed this with my friend, that those that work in this field, the special effects or the sculptures, they are collectors. They like to have a little bit of something that they've worked on, be it a Polaroid or an artifact or a hand they've made or a head. And I was told originally by Simon, he was our first tip-off about John Humphreys, that John had kept the head. He'd kept the head of one of the original dummies. He wasn't sure whether he still had it, but Simon had seen the head. I believed it was either in his workshop or his garage or wherever, but he did have the head of one of the dummies. Now, whether he still has it or not remains to be seen, because as you know as well as I do, Mark, we've not managed to interview John Humphreys in person as yet, but I'm pretty sure one day we will do. So I am confident that there is physical evidence there. We also know from Bob Kiviat's discussions with both John and his business manager, who is a bona fide business manager in the West End of London, that there's also a paper trail, which you could class as secondary physical evidence, for want of a better word, that will lead John directly back to Santilli. Now, this could be contracts, checks, monies, bank account statements, and that kind of thing. But this wasn't the kind of operation that was done, with a handshake over the table. It was all done, through John Humphrey's business manager. It was all legal and above board. So there is a variety of evidence there, Mark, that will lead us to the ultimate conclusion.
Great. I'm glad to hear it. I'll get off the phone now. Just check your email. I want to help you out on that special effects angle in the United States if I can.
Okay, Mark. You take care after the operation.
Okay, Mark. Thanks for being on the program. You know, I was in a store just yesterday, Philip, and they're starting to put out their Halloween stuff. And they are selling for $34 a head inside a crystal ball type thing. And you touch it, and the head talks. The eyes move and blink. For $34, I'm telling you, this looks so realistic. It's incredible. So you can imagine what Hollywood can do or what professionals can do when they want to make something that looks real and lifelike.
Well, absolutely, and you have to go back to the original Fox documentary with that Bob made. And interviewed on there was, the top special effects guy, Stan Winston. I mean, he's probably the top of the tree. And referring directly to the people who he believed, or the man who may have made the dummies, and he was so impressed with it, he'd give him a job tomorrow. So that,
I remember that.
Yeah, you couldn't get any higher accolade. And one of the things that John Humphreys has said in some TV and newspaper interviews he's done here, that was probably the hardest thing for him, was to keep quiet, because he had people like Winston and others saying what a great job he'd done. But as a professional, he couldn't hold his hands up and say thank you very much and, by the way, could I have a job, And so it was difficult for him to keep quiet as far as that side of things was concerned. But the things that Winston made, of course, for Jurassic Park were full-size dinosaurs that moved. So, the movie people can recreate just about anything.
If they have the money to spend, they can do it.
Absolutely. The one thing we don't know about the alien autopsy film and the dummies and things is how much it all costs. We've no idea as such. But I'm sure we'll get to it. Again, my friend who worked in the movies, he estimated about, he could have done it at that time for about £10,000, maybe about $15,000. If you were out of work, you know, and that kind of thing, so it's not a huge amount of money. You know, the actual bits and pieces that you need to buy to make these kind of dummies are not that expensive. It's the manpower that would cost you if you had to pay for it.
Well, I'm sure they got their money back 10 times over.
Oh, absolutely.
Next up, first-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Bob in Oregon, Wisconsin.
Hey, Bob, thanks.
Yeah, we're about 7 miles south of the state capital. I wanted to tell you, and I want to congratulate Philip for pumping some adrenaline into this discussion. It's greatly done.
You're welcome.
56 years ago, I was an Air Force sergeant in Wing Intelligence, just a few years after the Roswell information came to the fore. We didn't get a real workup on that. I was cleared for secret documents, but not top secret. Therefore, George, I don't know much about the order to shoot down.
I understand.
Yeah, but all the other stuff came right across my desk. And I was looking at them one day, and there was a document that told of a flight of 3 jet planes chasing a UFO described as a saucer. And the leader of the flight told his 2 compatriots, "You guys go back. I'm going to turn off on the burner here and see if I can catch up with this thing." Well, they went back and they called him, and he said, "I haven't caught him yet, but I'm gaining a little bit, so I'm just going to keep on pumping it." So he did. Then they heard nothing from him, and he never came back. And this is in the report. And it said that air and ground search crews could find not one scintilla of evidence that his airplane ever existed. They never found a body. They never found anything of the aircraft.
You think it's the prime cover-up?
Oh, yeah, good grief. Back in 1950, they were right on top of it.
Yeah.
Let me tell you another tale here. It's the same office. Colonel Anderson from across the hall was the wing operations officer in charge of all flights, which meant all of the airplanes under our wing commander. He came in while we were discussing this, and my colonel was a good friend of his, and he said, "Look, Dick," he says, "let's don't talk about flying saucers anymore. You remember about 4 years ago when I was a first pilot for Chicago and Southern Airlines, I came up to make a landing, and I was followed by a cigar-shaped outfit with amber lights all around it. I called down and told the people at the airport. I made maneuvers. This thing did similar maneuvers. I could never shake it until I got to the airport. And then when I landed, we got out of the plane. It was a night flight. Everybody was asleep but me and the co-pilot. We saw this thing. We got out as the last 2. We were greeted by 3 guys in black suits, and they said, 'You saw nothing, you heard nothing, and you will say nothing, or you'll regret it for the rest of your life.'" He said, I don't want to hear about these things anymore." I believe that these colonels are right. I think Colonel Corso also is right. He had a memo at the back of his book from General Nathan Twining, head of the Air Force, when I was in. And Twining's memo, if you'll dig it up in the appendix, says these objects are real. They are not figments. Treat them as such and report every one of them to my headquarters. Finally, going about 25 years later, my 2 teenage sons saw a saucer in Pierce, South Dakota. It was nuzzled up to one of those tall electric towers, you know?
Yeah.
And seemed to be drawing juice from it. My oldest son, who was 15 or 16, saw it, told me. He said, "Dad, I stopped my car, I looked at it, and all of a sudden a blue or green light came out of it and started heading toward me." He said, "I jammed the accelerator down and I climbed the hill." We were on a hillside. "And just ran in the house, and I was scared." And his sister said, "Dad, he was so scared, he climbed under his bed. He couldn't stand it." Well, his younger brother came by in another car shortly after that and saw a saucer flying away. So he and the older brother got together a few hours later, and they drew a diagram of it. The older brother saw the top of the thing. My younger brother saw the bottom of it. They drew a diagram. Our next door neighbor was an FBI agent. We took it over to him and described what had happened. He said, "I will take it out to Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, and we'll find out if they spotted anything."
Did he?
Of course, the Air Force said nothing.
Yeah.
We didn't see anything. But my son saw it. Hey, all this evidence all the way back to 1950, and people are still saying, "Hey, are they real?" I knew back in 1950 they were real. These are incontrovertible evidences, these kernels. They aren't lying, but as Philip said, you got to have hard evidence. All I can give you is, I guess, it's not apocryphal. I'll just give you this oral evidence. I believe in them, have since 1950, and I keep wondering why this stuff is all shut down.
Is it shut down, Philip, or can we just try to leak it out once in a while?
Well, I don't think it's shut down at all. I mean, it's great what Bob has just had to say there. I mean, it emphasizes exactly what we were talking about earlier, George, about the military. We only know the tip of the iceberg, quite literally. And they were told to keep quiet. You haven't seen anything. You saw nothing. And it still goes on today. I think it's more of out of embarrassment than anything else, whether it's anything official. But, you know, it's the tip of the iceberg. How many more people like Bob are there out there, both from back from the 50s or even today, who have seen these things firsthand? You know, we talked about, you know, pilots and aircraft disappearing. I mean, one of the most, you know, famous pilots perhaps of his time was Gordon Cooper, you know, who became astronaut Gordon Cooper.
Oh, sure.
And Gordon Cooper had his own UFO sightings whilst he was a pilot in flight in Germany. And later he went on to say that, you know, he had film in his hand of a UFO landing at a military base in the United States. He didn't view the film, he didn't see the landing, but he had the film in his hand. And he went on the record quite categorically saying that UFOs were not of this world. He became astronaut Gordon Cooper. So it's still there, it's still happening, and thankfully there's still people like Bob who are willing to go on the record and say, "Look, when I was involved in the military, this is what I saw, this is what I experienced." But there's a whole lot more out there that haven't gone on the record, and it would be great if they would.
As a matter of fact, Bill Burns is going to be my guest Tuesday night as we talk about Philip Corso and the day after Roswell. Very compelling information.
Absolutely.
Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Glenn from Nashville.
Glenn, thanks for calling.
Ask your guest. I worked at the Nevada test site in the early 60s, had a high Q clearance. And when Russia set off that megaton bomb they set off into Siberia, we had pictures of that device that was taken with a reverse-engineered UFO that we had. And did he ever hear anything about that? Because we knew that they didn't have a rocket that would get that thing off the ground at the time, and yet we was carrying around 220-megaton bombs and planes.
Never heard anything about that particular incident at the time. I mean, like anything from the Soviet Union, it was locked tight. I mean, it was only those that, you know, higher echelons of the U.S. military that knew what was going on there because of the spying and the satellite and so on. We poor people in the UFO research community knew virtually nothing. Like I said, one of the outlets for material from the Soviet Union was Dr. Felix Siegel. I mean, he was locked up at one point. He was imprisoned for it, you know. But a few of his books, you know, sneaked out through whatever means, and were translated into English. So we got to know very, very little. If, you know, compared to what information was there, we got to know absolutely nothing that was happening. And it's one of the reasons, like I said, that Paul and I decided to write Mysterious Sky, was to try and get as much information out there as we could to show, you know, the bravery. And I use that word correctly, the bravery of Soviet UFO researchers. I mean, there's no UFO researcher that I know, certainly in the UK, that would ever have their life threatened because of their interest in this subject, no matter what they did. But these people literally did face the death penalty at one point. It's hard to imagine here in the West, but they did. So that's another reason for writing the book. But we heard nothing about that particular incident at all, Glenn.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. Let's go to West of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello? 1, 2, 3.
Hello?
There you go. Hi.
Oh, George.
Yeah.
Trucking through Louisiana, and I really enjoyed your show. I've been listening to Art a long time, and then been listening to you since you've been on.
Thank you.
I have a video at home with Chuck Harder and Stan Freeman. They were going over the Art Thompson movie, and they both seemed to think that it was both made on an old film old camera that would have been used in that particular era we were supposed to make.
In 47. Yeah, you may be right about that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'd like to interject that it was filmed with a Filmo camera. And it was used 16mm film, which you can still obtain today. I mean, one of the things that John Humphrey said is that they went to great lengths, planned it meticulously to make it look authentic. And one of the ways to do that was to use the same type of camera equipment that was used during the era. Same with the artifacts you see on the film, like the knives and the surgical instruments and the clock on the wall and the phone. They were all circa 1947. But one of the things they didn't want to do was to get them from a museum, because they would have looked old.
Good
point.
They had
to look as if they were the original at the time.
And somebody might have said something.
Absolutely. But they did use, again, you know, a Filmo 16mm camera to film the alien autopsy film, because had it been filmed on anything else, you know, we would have been able to spot it straight away and it would have died a death. But it was filmed with an old Filmo camera, but filmed in the 1990s.
Did Santilli do this all for money?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the film itself has made millions, and I mean that, millions, the world. It was shown in over 20 different countries. He licensed it off to each different country. I mean, just in the United States alone, I believe Fox paid something like $250,000.
Gosh.
And then there was the video release, of which Santilli had royalties from the video release. And you have to remember, in 1995, I think it was the biggest-selling documentary of the year, something like 100,000 copies, and he had a share of that. So, you know, they paid $60,000 for it to be released in France in a magazine, and you multiply that around the world. I mean, just do a Google search and punch in and see where the video, you know, all the DVDs still on sale. I mean, it's still on sale everywhere around the world.
All right, Philip, stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Do you believe our astronauts? I know that Edgar Mitchell has talked about his belief in life in space, but he has never admitted to me, Philip, that he saw anything or was followed by a UFO. But do you think our astronauts have seen something?
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. I mean, you know, I know Buzz Aldrin has perhaps tried to retract his statement that he made recently, but he's gone on the record. And, you know, once you've said it, it's too late to retract it. And we talked about Gordon Cooper. He saw something when he was a pilot. You know, and he later became an astronaut. But I have no doubt about it whatsoever. I mean, we've got some little bits and pieces of film footage, more so from, you know, the various shuttle missions that show UFOs in space, whatever UFOs are, that are anomalous objects in space. So I don't doubt it whatsoever. And I think that any documentary that can get to a number of the astronauts and actually interview them, whilst they may not admit to anything of a personal nature, I think his story, Musgrave, talks about the worms he's seen in space, and that there are some film up these little things that wriggle around. I think they would all, to a man, more or less, say that they have no doubt that life elsewhere does exist off planet, I think that would probably be universally accepted by them all. So, yeah, I've no doubt about it whatsoever. I mean, it's you know, as Buzz Aldrin said about the time of their sighting, you know, one of the reasons they didn't go public or didn't say anything on the air to NASA at the time is because they were worried that, you know, they were on their way to the moon, that it would get cancelled. And they think, you know, these guys have gone nuts, you know, bring them home before they had a chance to land.
Yeah, what's doing that to them?
Absolutely. And we also have to remember, whether you're an astronaut or a guy, you know, working on the bus or wherever, there is still a great deal of stigma attached to this subject. It's not as bad as it used to be, but there is still a great deal of stigma. If you stand up and say, you know, I've seen a UFO and this is what it looked like and this is where I was, it can have an adverse effect from people making fun of you to people thinking, well, should I promote this guy? You know, you know, this type of thing. So the stigma is still there. However, I think certainly over the last 10 years that has been reduced to a large degree, because we had people like the late Dr. John Mack, Harvard professor,
sure,
on the record. Here in the UK, with people like Nick Pope from the Ministry of Defence. I mean, Nick was the MOD officer who investigated UFOs for 3 years officially. Gone on the record, you know, stated his own, you know, not just talked about his work, but his own beliefs as well. So I think that has reduced the stigma somewhat, because these are people who have, again, more to lose than they have to gain by doing this. I mean, Nick has been promoted at the MOD, so it's not done his career any harm, because, you know, he's told the truth. And it did have, for a while, have a detrimental effect on the late Professor Mack. I mean, I believe, you know, Harvard tried to sort of investigate him to see if he was worthy of being on the faculty, but he was proved to be, you know, all above board. So, you know, I think, you know, the stigma has reduced. And you know, we've just had a caller from Bob, you know, from the military, going on the record. And I'm sure others will do as the time goes by. You're going to be speaking about Bill Burns and Colonel Corso. And thankfully, before Colonel Corso died, he went on the record. And he is who he says he is. He has a long and distinguished military career. More to lose than he had to gain. Simple as that.
That's an incredible story all by itself. First-time caller line. Good morning.
Well, good morning, George. What an honor. My name is Stacy.
I've been listening
to you guys for so long. Before I get to my question, though, I do have a question personally for you. Do you like to dance, George?
Do I like to dance?
I was prompted by Tommy to ask you that question.
Oh, good old Tom.
My question is, UFO phenomenon has been going on for decades, for so long. It's been even in the mainstream media. My question really is, has there been much advancement as far as national attention, something that finally our country, our government, overseas or not, has to address? I mean, it's overwhelming, the case studies and witnesses and testimony over the years and piles of paperwork on this. I was just wondering if anything is going to happen because of this. Is anybody going to actually address it?
I mean, it has been addressed before, but it's all been swept under the carpet. I mean, it could. Is it Stacy, did you say?
Yes.
Stacey, one of the reasons why you may not see anything from, you know, the President, our Prime Minister, Tony Blair, whoever, I mean, it's an argument that's often put forward, is that the powers that be already know what UFOs are. So they don't need to do any more. Maybe there's not a lot they can do about it. They are powerless to act. That the UFO phenomenon, by and large, is no threat. Same as, you know, us floating around the moon aren't a great deal of threat unless we crash again, you know. So it could well be that the powers that be are aware of the phenomenon. They know a great deal about it. It isn't a threat to mankind. There are those that claim they're in cahoots with, you know, the beings from another world. I'm not totally convinced of that myself. But it's like anything.
Right, but by sweeping it under the carpet, doesn't just that take away from their credibility altogether?
Well, that's something you'll have to judge for yourself, Stacey. I mean, these are your leaders. You elect them, same as we do here in the UK. So that's something that you'll have to, you know, make up for yourself, whether you think it destroys their credibility. On the other hand, they could be as dumbfounded as the rest of us and don't know what to do.
I mean, no way to really explain it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think UFO research has done a pretty good job. The vast majority of it is done by people like myself with no money, with no resources. I'm not a PhD. I have no degree. I am just me, who, for whatever reason, became fascinated by this subject, wanted to get to the bottom of it. And I think when you add all that up,
we've done a pretty good job. Imagine what we could do if we had resources, if we had some money, and we had time to dedicate to this and do it correctly, do it scientifically. I mean, you know, the potential is enormous. And if it is aliens from another world, then, you know, it opens up an all-new ballgame. And I think it's something that I've been asked time and time again. If the president or the head of the UN or the Pope, whoever, went on national TV tomorrow and stood there with an alien and said, you know, here they are, they're here, we know all about them, what effect would it have on mankind as a whole?
Or the philosophy of a person is smart, but people are stupid. You scream fire in a full theater, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah, I could only say what it would affect me as individual. I would still have to go to work tomorrow. I would still have to feed my kids. I would still have to pay my mortgage, you know. So the everyday things certainly wouldn't change as far as, you know, Joe Public is concerned. I still have to do that. But there would be bigger ramifications. Would it upset the religious churches around the world, for example? What would it do to the financial institutions around the world? You know, the world is run on oil, whether we like it or not. If we've got vehicles coming from A to B some other way, what then does it do to that?
Good
we've got
point.
A new power source that, you know, oil disappears tomorrow and we can, you know, plug or whatever in and off you go. So it has all different kinds of ramifications that could upset a whole host of things. But me as an individual, I still got to go to work in the morning. So something to think about, Stacey.
Stacey, thanks for your call. As far as the question about me dancing, well, you just never know. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Oh, George Norrie, you're doing great work.
Thanks.
This is Tom, Seattle, Washington.
All right, Tom.
Hey, I just had one question for your guest.
Okay.
And I'm going to cut to the quick.
He's ready to go.
Where in the world are these hotshot attorneys ready to take on anybody, anywhere, anytime, so that people who want to come forward can get protection? What is going on with
like the whistleblowers? Protect the whistleblowers.
Exactly.
Well, what are the
places? The legal protection?
You've got that in the United States. You've got it there. There's an organization called the Citizens Against UFO Secrecy.
Cause.
And it's run by bona fide attorneys. We call them lawyers and solicitors, attorneys. They have tried to sue the government every which way but loose, have had some success in getting documentation released and so on. But if there is a whistleblower, if you were a whistleblower, they are there for you. They can do it all for you, and it won't cost you a penny. Simple as that. So the protection is there if people want to come forward. So it's there. It's as simple as that.
Tom, thanks for your call. We'll take a few more as this quick night is rapidly coming to an end. Wildcard Line, hello there. Where are you calling from?
This is Wade from Vancouver Island.
Hi, Wade. Go ahead, sir.
I think I sent you an email with regard to a UFO that I thought I saw when I was quite young, probably 11 or 12 years old, and it was an elongated triangle that swept across the sky, and all I could see was reflected sunlight. It was that high up. It was an odd experience for me, and when I pointed it out to my father, he didn't believe me.
That's par for the course for a lot of people.
Oh, I know. It was kind of crazy. But
And of course, you're not alone in seeing the triangles at all. I mean, in more recent times, some of the most famous sightings around the world came from Belgium, and they were of a triangular object. Now, a lot of these were witnessed by the Belgian gendarmerie, the police, and there is one very, very clear photograph of this triangle with the three lights underneath. And you even have the Belgian military with state-of-the-art aircraft trying to intercept these flying triangles. And whilst they never managed to intercept them, what they did do, they got radar lock on, both airborne and ground radar, and there it is on radar. And it's there for all to see, and it dropped from a huge height to a few hundred feet in a matter of seconds. Such a maneuver would have killed any human pilot with the G-forces. So you're not alone in seeing the triangles. They're still around.
Do you believe, Philip, actually believe that these extraterrestrials have been in contact with governments? They have some kind of reciprocal arrangement? There's some kind of communication going on?
I would have to say this, that if the UFO subject is of an extraterrestrial nature, and we'll take that issue on for the sake of argument, we'll assume it is, and that the few sightings that remain unidentified are flying saucers and have occupants in there from another world, they have been around longer than since 1947, for an awful long time, then I think it's only logical to assume that somewhere along the line there has been interaction with the leaders of our world, be it your presidents, be it your military officials. I wouldn't doubt that whatsoever. I mean, we go back to the Rendlesham incident that I mentioned in 1980 here in the UK. It is said by some that there was interaction there between the occupants of this craft and the military officials that were there at the time. So, yes, I'd have to say, if we are dealing with an extraterrestrial phenomenon, I would have no doubt that that may have happened or should have happened somewhere. With whom? I couldn't pinpoint to any one particular person, but you would have to assume, you know, the highest military officials and even, not necessarily, but even up to, you know, presidents. No doubt about it.
East of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, George. Hi, it's Steve from Pittsburgh.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have to agree with your guest, though, what he said earlier about the government and why they don't acknowledge it and say there's an elephant in the living room, because what's the big deal? We have to live every day and just go on with our lives. But I have a quick story about Puerto Rico. I work with a man down there at the airport, and his wife went out one time with her sister to a country house, and they sat on the porch looking out over the hills, and they heard a loud humming sound and saw this large silver dome come rising up over a hill. Well, they panicked and ran inside the house and locked the door. The next thing they heard was footsteps on the roof, and the next thing they knew, they woke up in the bedroom facing each other across the room, and an hour had gone by from 4 o'clock to 5, and they had no idea what happened.
Lost time, abducted case.
Yes, that's it. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Appreciate that. We didn't have enough time, Philip, to get into abductions and what's been going on over in the former Soviet Union. But as you admitted briefly at the beginning, it is happening.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the skeptics will try and tell you that people who experience, you know, the abductions always experience them in some remote vicinity and there's never anyone else around and you know, they're a little bit off the wall. Well, that's not the case. The abduction experiences take place here, there, and everywhere via a cross spectrum of the community, from a doctor to a pilot to a, you know, a road sweeper to a, you know, construction worker. Quite literally, whatever these experiences are, you know, they happen here, there, and everywhere, including in the cities, in rural areas, in the towns. Again, most of the people who have these experiences don't want to go on the record. They simply want to put it behind them. They want to forget about it. But like the rest of the UFO subject, there are a number of brave individuals willing to go on the record because they believe this is important, that people should know about this, that this is happening. They don't necessarily say they've been abducted by aliens. They say that I had this most bizarre experience, and this is what it is. Again, the skeptics will say, oh, it's all the result because they had hypnosis. Well, that's not true. I think of roughly about half of abductees never go anywhere near hypnosis. They can remember everything. They don't have to go near a hypnotist. You know, they don't have to have hypnotherapy or regressive hypnosis. They can remember it. So, you know, the whole UFO subject and certainly abductions are questions waiting to be answered. And these are the questions that the skeptics can't ignore. I mean, we have a new magazine in the UK called UFO Data, UFO Data, and it's available at ufodata.co.uk. And basically, it's an information. We've put these information out there, and we've got an article now about Gordon Cooper and his sightings and some of the other things at NASA, and they're all questions waiting to be answered. We know a lot of them. We've answered a lot of the questions, a lot more to go.
Whatever happened in the Ural Mountains up there?
Well, we mentioned here earlier that certain areas around the world that seem to have, they've been nicknamed window areas, for want of a better word, that seem to have concentrations of paranormal phenomena. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Not just UFOs.
You're almost done, Philip. You're almost done.
The Urals is one of them. The Ural Mountains has everything you can think of. It has paranormal phenomena, the UFO sightings. It's there. It's one of those window areas. It, literally everything has happened.
We have that here with Mount Shasta.
Absolutely. We have it here with the Pennine Hills of northern England. It's in the Hestaland Valley of central Norway, and so on. It's around the world. There are these window areas, and the Ural Mountains are another one of these.
We've got time for one more quick question. Let's go to our wild card line. I only have about a minute for you. Go ahead, please.
Hey, George. This is Jason from Texas.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah, me and my dad were coming back from a job around midnight, and we stopped at this car dealership to, like, look at some trucks. And, like, in the back, there had, like, a whole bunch of new trucks that had just came in. And I swear, me, both and my dad, we saw an alien or creature or something jumping on the cars, like, on the hoods of the car.
You and, sure you know, now?
And I, like, freaked out.
Where did he go? And, he just kept hopping on them?
Yeah, he hopped on it and jumped over the, like, building and just vanished.
You know, I get a lot of calls like this, Philip, that people go camping and they see these creatures everywhere. They are strange stories.
Absolutely. I mean, there's one here from the northeast of England that I remember vividly. You know, a chap just driving to work the same route he'd done every morning, and there was a goblin running along the side of the road. It was raining.
Everywhere. Man,
it was
unbelievable. Philip, thank you. We're out of time. Mysterious Sky, Amazon.com, right?
Yeah, and ufodata.co.uk.
You got it. Philip Mantle, his links are up there at coasttocoastam.com. For Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Dan Brady helping out this week, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there in Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.